Walter Lantz was an animator and a cartoonist who created the character Woody Woodpecker. The idea for that character came during his honeymoon with his wife Grace in Lake Sherwood, California, where a noisy acorn woodpecker outside of their cabin had kept the couple awake for several nights. And when heavy rain started, they learned that the bird had bored holes in the cabin's roof. Walter wanted to shoot the bird, putting him and the bird out of their misery, but Grace insisted and suggested to her husband to instead make a cartoon about the bird, whereby Woody Woodpecker was born. This concept is true in Yiddishkeit as well, that we are expected to see things around us and take lessons from them, not to simply put them away or close them out, but to incorporate them into our lives. And the same is true in Torah and mitzvot as well, that when we do a mitzvah, we're supposed to extract gain from the experience. And there are special symbolisms and meanings and ideas that are sometimes more obviously placed, sometimes more hidden in the very mitzvot that we do, that our task is to try to gain and learn from those messages. And in Parshas Naso, Perek Hey, Pasuk Tes Vav, the Torah describes the carbon of a sota, a woman who is suspected of being unfaithful to her husband, and her husband has properly warned her. She's went into seclusion with a man. She's suspected of committing adultery. She has to bring a carbon. And the Torah describes what this carbon consists of. And Rashi, based on the Medrash, notes that we pay particularly close attention to what is and what is not in this carbon. So what's in the carbon? So it's a carbon of Asiris Ha'efa Kemach Sa'orim. It's an Asiris Ha'efa of barley flour. Lo Yitzak Alav Shemen. There may not be any oil in this carbon. V'lo Yitein Alav Levona. There may not be any frankincense in this carbon. And the carbon should be placed in a Kli Cheres, in an earthenware vessel. Rashi tells us that each of these have symbolism, have unique symbolism. The fact that the carbon must be from barley flour and not wheat flour is to indicate that this woman perhaps did a maisa, did an act of a behemah, like an animal, if in fact she committed adultery. So her carbon should mirror that and contain barley, which is animal food. There's no oil in this carbon. Oil is a hiddur, oil is extra nice. Oil is called light. It's called yitzar, which means light. And she did this act in secret. She did this act in darkness. So she's not worthy to have oil in her carbon. The carbon doesn't have lavona. It doesn't have frankincense. As the imahos, our matriarchs, Sarah, Rivka, Rachel, and Leah, were called lavona. As the pasuk in Shir HaShirim, Perek Dalid, pasuk Vav says, El givas halavona, and to the hill of frankincense. And this sota went away from the path of the Imahos by not acting in a tzanua way. The Sefer HaChinuch even counts this as a lav, a losase, not to put lavona in this carbon. Finally, we put the carbon in a kli cheres, in an earthenware vessel, as she must have given her fellow adulterer fine wine in a beautiful, a nice cup. So she's forced to drink bitter waters from a disgusting, lowly cup of earthenware. And these are all the symbolisms that are encapsulated in the carbon that the sota brings. There was a Rav, Rav Yosef Yehuda Leiblach, who lived from 1860 to 1929. He studied in Volozhin and the Musar of Kelm. He married the daughter of Rav Eliezer Gordon, the Rosh Yeshiva of Telz. And when Rav Gordon passed away in 1910, Rav Yosef Yehuda Leiblach took over as Rosh Yeshiva of Telz, and he has a very important sefer called Shiurei Das, which contains many fundamental principles of Musar. And in the Shiurei Das, in Chilek Beis, in Milas HaTorah Shir Aleph, which was given over Erev Parshas Naso in the Yeshiva in Telz in the year 1916, he notes that it seems all of this, all the symbolism that goes into the carbon of the sota, the goal is twofold. Number one, to make an impact on the sota herself, that she should take heed of all these symbolisms and recognize her negative ways, even if she's found innocent, as she's still guilty of allowing herself to be suspected by her husband. And so for her to interpret and to understand the symbolism of her karban. Alternatively, it's for those who see this process and for those who understand and are able to gain insight into how negative this type of behavior is. However, Rav Bloch asks a very interesting question. He says, how are these signs supposed to make an impact on anybody, whether it be the sota or the bystander? These signs are not at all obvious. They're not at all apparent. The fact that there's no oil or frankincense in the karban, is that something that the sota or the bystander is going to pick up on and then imply, oh, there's no oil because she did something in the dark? Oh, there's no lavona because she didn't act like the imahos. And there's also no ketchup and mustard. If we're really trying to make a point or make a statement or have a karban that contains lessons of impact, asked Rav Bloch, wouldn't the Torah have been better to provide a karban with more blatant and obvious symbolisms that would automatically trigger something in the mind of the sota or the bystander, rather than to give these seemingly subtle and light symbolisms? So Rav Bloch answers, the symbolisms that the Torah gives are not as small or weak as we think. As even if on the surface, when you look at it, you would say that the person doesn't feel an immediate impact because the message is not obvious, it's not clear, it doesn't hit you in the face. But these messages still would impact the nefesh, the soul of a person, as it's possible that something could affect the nefesh of a person without him even knowing it. For example, we know that a person can be carrying an object. He can space out, lose focus. He drops the item. He breaks it. Do we say that the person had intention to break that item? No. But he did commit an act which caused this item to break. And says Rav Bloch, the same is true spiritually. There can be a hisorus in the nefesh. There can be a rejuvenation. There can be an experience which elevates without a person feeling it or even realizing it. There are many factors that affect how and why a person does what he does day in and day out. We don't even realize why we do most of the things we do. According to many studies, about 70 or 80% of what we do each day is by rote, is by habituation. We're not actually making conscious decisions because this is what we do every day. We begin to do things without even thinking. So we're not present. We're not intending with our full minds and consciousness to do them. If a person, for example, says Rav Bloch, drinks water every night before he goes to sleep, over and over again, at a certain point, as he's putting on his pajamas, he begins to get thirsty. This is his custom, his maisa, and therefore his hisorus is not even intended. Therefore, says Rav Bloch, the simanim, the symbolism that the Torah gives us for the carbon of the sota, they're there. They might be subtle. A person might not be cognizant of them. They might not have the major impact. They don't pack the punch like others would. But we can't underestimate the power that even small symbolisms can have in our nefesh. But Rav Bloch asks, the question still somewhat remains, as even though we've pointed out that small and seemingly unrecognizable symbolisms and messages can indeed have an effect on our nefesh, but wouldn't a more obvious and blunt impact statement symbolism have been a better choice? It could have had a greater impact on the sota and the bystanders, but Rav Bloch answers no. He wants to suggest a chiddush that is counterintuitive. It could be the greatest impact is actually felt through messages that are not obvious, but are smaller and subtle. When you have big signs, when you have big impacts, they're so recognizable, they're in your face,
at the time, they're great. And they cause a great hisorus, a desire to grow. But it's mostly external. Whereas small, subtle impacts can build up over time and can have a lasting impact. And Rav Bloch says this explains why at the Seder on Pesach, everything we do is a zecher. The maror is zecher to the bitter. We lean because we feel free. We don't do anything big. We don't go huge. And we repeat every single year. Why not have a big production? Have a crazy party? Act out the story with drama? The answer is, as we just mentioned, Chazal put these remembrances not so that we change any one thing right now, but so that the messages of Pesach and freedom and slavery can seep into our very being over time. And Rav Bloch says, this also explains the Medrash in Pinchas, which says that by Shmini Atzeres, as opposed to the other 7 days of Sukkot, where it's 13, 12, 11 Karbanos in descending order, on Shmini Atzeres, all we bring is a Parachad and an Ayilachad. So the Medrash says, it's compared to a king. He makes a big feast for 7 days, invites everyone. At the end, after everyone leaves, and all that's remaining is his family, he says to them, now that it's just us, let's have a piece of fish. Let's have a piece of meat together. So the Hashem is saying to us, let's just have a parechad, an ayelechad. And Rav Bloch says, the 7 days of Sukkot, the 70 cumulative karbanos, correspond to the 70 nations of the world. There's much fanfare. Everything's big. 13 karbanos. Ashmini Atzeres, which is the most love, which is just us and Hashem, we tone it down. As the closer we get to Hashem, the more we peel away the chitzonios, the external, the major impact, and we focus on the panemius, something internal, which sometimes is more subtle, but often has a longer lasting impact. This week, unfortunately, we lost a great Torah giant, a pillar of the Jewish community in the United States and beyond, Rabbi Norman Lamb. I thought it would be appropriate to mention a teaching that he referenced in a drasha he gave in the Jewish Center, Parshas Naso, May 31st, 1969, where he quotes the Chozem Milublin, who comments on the pasuk in Birchas Kohanim, where we say, Yivarechecha Hashem v'yishmerecha. Kadosh Baruch Hu should give us blessing, and He should guard us. V'yishmerecha, He should watch over us. However, the Chozeh provided an alternative explanation. V'yishmerecha could also come from the word shmarim, which can mean yeast. And I'll read what Rabbi Lamb wrote in his eloquent words. Rabbi Lamb writes, the blessing of the Almighty lies in this, that the life of Torah and mitzvos is like a yeast introduced into our soul, which causes it to ferment slowly, quietly, imperceptibly, but always developing, growing, rising, maturing, and elevating, almost unnoticed, as we add insight to insight, mitzvah to mitzvah, good deed to good deed, kindness to kindness, our very interiority begins to expand, our yearning increases, and the curtain between the natural and the supernatural parts ever so slightly, affording us illuminating insights into the realms beyond and within, giving us an awareness of the transcendent, of the supernatural, and increasing our love for God Himself. If we think about Torah and mitzvos, about our tradition and its practices, and we think about Rabbi Lamb's message and the message of Rabbi Bloch, it's not about one moment or one event. Yiddishkeit's not about the major impact. It's about a lifetime, and it's about the day-to-day, which can at times feel or seem mundane and trivial, but without us even realizing, is having major effects on us as people, as good Jews, on our neshamos. The goal is not for extraordinary acts. It's for small, perhaps subtle symbolisms, messages, reminders, and remembrances, which, with repetition and over time, can act like yeast and are able to transform us, slowly but surely, into avadim, into servants of HaKadosh Baruch Hu.